Hello, and welcome to the fifth installment of Leaders and Lulz Virtual Discussion Series.
Today we are joined by Deval Patrick, the former governor of Massachusetts and a former candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination.
We hope you enjoy the discussion.
Governor Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Bridget. Thanks for having me. And to you too, Daniel.
So to start off, could you give us a brief overview of your career?
Sure. Well, let's see. I grew up on the south side of Chicago. I lived there with my mother and my sister and various other relatives who came and went in our grandparents' two-bedroom tenement, much of that time on welfare. I got a break when I was 14 years old through a scholarship through a program called A Better Chance to go to Milton Academy, which for me was like landing on a foreign planet. I was there for 4 years, went on to college, first in my family to go, and then lived in Africa for a year working with the UN. I came back to Harvard for law school, and after law school joined and moved out to California, and I was clerking for a federal judge, planning to join a law firm in San Francisco. I met there the woman who's now my wife, and we ended up moving to New York, where I became a civil rights lawyer for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And then after our first child was born, in about 3 years' time, we moved to Boston, where I joined a private law firm and spent about 30% of my time on civil rights and the rest in business litigation. In 1994, I think it was, I was by President Clinton to head the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department in his first term, and lived and worked in and out of Washington for that first term, then came back to Boston and joined a law firm where I was until I became general counsel for Texaco and subsequently the Coca-Cola Company. And decided after a number of years in those roles that I wanted to run for governor and did in my first race in 2006 and won and served two terms. After those two terms, we don't have term limits in Massachusetts, but I have a term limit named Diane who said two terms and that's it, you gotta come home. And then I launched a new business in private equity, investing in companies for both financial return and social or environmental impact. And that is a summary of my career.
So you've obviously had an incredible career. Do you think there were any kind of formative experiences that you had growing up on the south side of Chicago in a lower income family that helped you get where you are today?
You know, I was blessed that I had teachers and other adults who paid attention. You know, I had a sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Quaintance, who, they had very high expectations of us in that classroom, and they taught us to have high expectations of ourselves. And I think, there were plenty of other not so positive influences around, but to have those teachers in particular and other adults in the neighborhood really kind of focus in and encourage you. In my own family, no one in my family had ever gone to college, but nobody said I couldn't. It was an expectation. They didn't know how it was going to happen. It was something they prayed about and cared about and encouraged me to believe it.
Well, that's obviously, it's wonderful to have a supportive family, and it definitely makes an impact on everyone. But that also led you to be the president of the Harvard Legal Aid Bureau and work to defend families in Middlesex County, which is actually where we're based in Lowell.
That's right, yeah.
What were some of the primary issues you saw people facing, and how did you work to address those issues?
Well, at that time, the issues that came to us were landlord-tenant issues, evictions, and so forth. In fact, my very first trial was on behalf of a Haitian family in Somerville whose landlord was trying to evict them, even though he had not provided reliable heat and hot water there were broken windows and cold air came in the wintertime. It's a terrible situation. So a lot of those kinds of cases came. We also had domestic issues where people were really in unhealthy relationships, sometimes dangerous relationships, domestic relationships, and needed divorces or needed restraining orders. They were harder to get and harder to afford for people. And then there were benefits questions, just being able to access benefits that to which people were entitled, but through a system that was incredibly hard to navigate. And I think in some ways, you know, the way people were trying to have their problems addressed through any variety of kinds of bureaucracies and still maintain their dignity was something that I saw and that I was sensitive to, ways that so many folks made poor and vulnerable people feel demeaned and feel small, as if they were an inconvenience of some kind. And I think we tried at the Legal Aid Bureau to bring not just great service, but a sense of dignity to our clients as well. And I think that mattered to them.
So also on the topic of dignity, you worked in both the private and public sector to address social issues. So what were some of the barriers you faced pushing controversial issues forward?
Well, you know, in many cases, controversy comes because the issue you're pushing is just unfamiliar, right? It's just people who say, well, we haven't done it this way before, or we haven't worked with those kinds of people before, or, you know, we have our tried and true ways, although in many cases, those tried and true ways weren't getting really great results. And so I think it was persuasion, but and the importance of persuasion, the importance of being urgent about change, but also I think leaving room for other people's points of view, other people's anxiety, you know, kind of putting them at ease so you could get on with doing what needed to be done. And that takes, I think, more restraint than I thought I had at different times, but I do think it's what brought, in the best cases, lasting change.
And so, as you said before, during the Clinton administration, you were the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division. So you were dealing with issues of race on a daily basis. Where do you see the state of race relations today in the U.S., particularly given events in the news, like the murder of Ahmaud Arbery and everything like that?
Yeah, you know, race is one of the hardest issues for Americans to talk about and to deal with, in part because we have two realities. We have extraordinary progress, much of it in my own lifetime. At the same time, we have so much work to do. And the unaccountability of police in the Arbery shooting, or in, you know, so many others that I've dealt with and seen, the ways in which it is still harder for Black and Brown people, and in many cases for women, to be paid as much for the same work that white men do. We still have issues with diversity in business leadership all over the country, and the development of the tools to ready yourself for business leadership. And frankly, if you just think about what's happening now, what we see today around the impact of COVID-19. The folks who are most at risk are the ones who are already compromised from the perspective of health, and those disparities run deep along racial and ethnic lines, and there's a reason for that. And so I feel because of what I've seen in my own lifetime, you know, when I was a kid, it was illegal for Black and white people to marry. That we are capable as a country to confront and to close the gap between our reality and our ideals. But it at times has felt to me like we were just lacking in leadership and in will. And right now we have leadership, it feels to me, who spend a lot of time trying to stoke division, which to me is an abdication of leadership, and not enough leadership on the other political side, anyway, willing to call that what it is and then offer a real alternative.
So on the same topic, you were the first and currently only Black governor in our state's history. How significant a step was your election for Massachusetts, and did you feel any added pressure on the job because your election was so historic?
Wow, there's a lot in that question. So first of all, it was humbling and exciting and affirming in many ways, not just to win, but to win so convincingly. I wouldn't say I was surprised, although a lot of folks from outside of Massachusetts were surprised, because we don't have a very large African-American population, comparatively speaking, proportionally speaking. I guess I will also say that the way Doug Wilder once put it, Doug Wilder was the first African-American governor elected in America. He was elected in Virginia. And he introduced me once by saying, you know, people make a lot of fuss about him being the first. He said, being the first doesn't mean a thing unless there's a second. And the point is that we must all lift as we climb. And so I've tried to be a good mentor to other young African-American and other aspiring political activists and leaders, because I do think you have to pass it on. I think that the hardest part about it for me in the job was that the expectations of me were different than they are for many governors. I remember we had a series of shootings in Roxbury, an African-American community in Boston. And these would normally be responded to by local leadership, by the mayor, community leaders and so on. But the community and the media expected me to have something to say about those. They don't the current governor, they didn't the governor before me, but they did expect me to have something to say about it. And I think at the beginning I resisted that, to tell you the truth, because it felt like a double standard. It felt like you were taking on a kind of responsibility for which, you know, I didn't actually have any authority to do much, or at least I didn't think I did. But over time, I began to not just accept it, but actually to embrace it, because we had run a very grassroots campaign. It was very much about connecting with people and re-engaging them in their own political and civic future all over the Commonwealth. And the fact that people felt they had a personal stake in our administration and in me isn't something that I should have felt at any time I could just put aside until the next campaign. And so it was consistent, I think, with that philosophical approach to stay engaged and close to people in African-American communities and all kinds of communities. And when I kind of made my peace with that, I stopped fretting over the different standard. You know, you never quite get used to, but you become numb to some of the racist commentary, the way, you know, for example, you had to get a car, you had to ride in a car that was fitted out with a police package, you know, with lights and sirens and all that sort of thing. And some fortification. And we ordered a new car for me, and it was referred to in one of the papers as being tricked out. I mean, come on, what is that? So you have to look past that kind of thing in order to do the job, but it was there.
So you mentioned mentorship earlier. How do you think young people especially can find mentors to help them on their journey to leadership and then become a mentor later on?
You know, I think let me talk about mentors generally and then in politics. When I was coming up, we were all about, you know, how the generation before us was out of step. They didn't know anything. And you know, we were probably right about a lot of that in the way that your generation is right about us. But there were still insights about human behavior and the way systems worked or didn't, about insights into my own strengths and weaknesses that were useful to have from people who had experienced more of life, if not the same things, just more of life. And I think sometimes there's a mentorship that happens when you don't even realize it's happening. I think one of the people who had the most impact on me was a bus driver whose name I never knew and only met once, so far as I know, when I was late to catch a bus to get someplace in Chicago. And I got on, and at that time you still had to put money in the fare box. And I realized only after the bus was moving that I didn't have enough money for the fare. And instead of dressing me down, he said to me simply, "Pass it on, son, just pass it on." And it was an amazing gesture of grace. And it's the sort of thing that, frankly, I mean, sounds weird to say it or corny, but it made me want to be a better person because it had such an impact on me, recognizing it. That's a kind of mentorship. I think in politics, it is so hard to be new, to break in, especially if you're trying to do what I did by cutting the line. You know, we have a very tight, inward-looking political establishment. So having people who would bring me in and decode stuff for me is also true in the private sector. You work in a place, people know the backstories, they know each other, they have relationships. Mentorship is about someone who just cracks the code for you. They help you understand what the subtext is. And it doesn't take a lot of time, but it can be hugely impactful in terms of your success. And by the way, young people mentor other young people too. And they mentored me as governor. I remember I mentioned earlier this experience with this rash of violence in communities of color. And I remember once being out talking with a group of young people, and they asked me if I had a formal mechanism to take the input of young people into policy making, policy deliberation. I did not, and it was on account of them that we created something called the Governor's Youth Council. It was statewide, it was enormously important. They proposed and we moved at least one piece of legislation. It was an anti-bullying bill. But, you know, if you're not listening to people, including young people, and listening for what is different about a young person's voice and needs, it's hard to see yourself as doing the whole job. So I thank the young people who have been mentors to me as well.
So a huge plight of young people right now is the cost of college education. So as governor, you tried to push reforms to lower the cost of public education. Why do you think this is important, and how do you think we as a nation can work to improve the cost of college education?
So I think that historically, education has been an essential part of American economic mobility. the fact that economic mobility has been so compromised over, you know, the last many decades is the reason we have the extreme income inequality that is all around us today. And we've been chipping away at what makes it possible for people to move from their station of birth to the place they imagine themselves and their families being able to reach for. And I don't mean physically, I mean just being able to see yourself as a lawyer in my case, as a teacher, as whatever it is you want to be, and the tools it takes to get there. And college has been, and I think will remain, an essential part of that. And that means you have to have an affordable option. Public colleges and universities for a long time were that affordable option. But what's been happening is that in Massachusetts and elsewhere, we've been slowly draining the public out of public colleges and universities. So as the cost continued to increase and there was less and less public appropriation, state appropriation for colleges and universities, more and more of that fell to tuition. And there was a strategy borrowed from private colleges and universities that said, you know, high tuition, high aid, meaning charge as much as the so-called market would bear. And then for those who couldn't afford it, aid would be available. Where two things were wrong with that. One, the aid was never available, and increasing at the same pace. And more of that aid became weighted toward loans and not grants, which is why we have the student debt crisis we have today. A crisis, by the way, that could be eradicated by refinancing the debt to current levels and doing that, current interest rates, and doing that retrospectively, which would eliminate most of it, and paying off the balance with a small increase in the estate tax. But that's another question. And so what we tried to do when I was in office, even during a global economic collapse and very, very tight resources, we tried to increase the state appropriation to higher ed to 50-50 in exchange for an agreement to freeze tuition and fees. And that worked, you know, as far as it went. We got that agreement. We got that aid from the legislature. In years since, I believe that, you know, we were trending in the right direction. But in years since, I think we've reversed that, and costs have continued to go up, and tuition and fees have continued to go up. And we do that, I think, at the peril of our future.
So switching gears just a little bit to talk about the upcoming election in November. Do you see voter suppression as a big issue coming up as we approach November? And how is the ongoing pandemic going to affect voter turnout and all issues like that?
Well, Daniel, I'm worried about voter suppression. You know, we've been fretting over it for a long time, but we've seen it in the past. We saw it most recently in the special elections in Wisconsin, the primary election in Wisconsin. It was glaring. It was shameless. The Supreme Court gutted a very important part of the Voting Rights Act, the enforcement of which I was once responsible for when I was in the Justice Department. And they said it was time to do that because conditions had all changed. You know, not 15 minutes after that decision, people went back to the same shenanigans they'd been doing before. And, you know, I'm a Democrat, but I'm not the sort of Democrat who thinks you have to hate Republicans to be a good Democrat. I have been astonished by the coordination among Republican activists all over the country to make it harder to vote rather than easier, which is what you would think would be the objective of a healthy democracy. So I'm very much worried about that. It didn't just happen, you know, sort of in the run-up to the current election, to the election coming in November. It's been happening over a long period of time with voter ID laws and purging of voter lists, which is a practice of removing people from the list if they haven't voted, which, by the way, is your right. You don't get, you know, you don't get your driver's license taken away if you don't drive for a period of time. But so that's been happening. There was an effort in Florida, a popular petition on a bipartisan basis that passed, that returned the franchise, the ability to vote, to former felons that had done their time. And it passed overwhelmingly, and the new Republican governor came in and started to and put into place all of these burdens on that right. It said, well, you have not just done your time, but you have to pay all your court fees and all that sort of thing. And these are poor people. And, you know, the chances of being able to do that quickly, he knew and everyone else knew were remote. And I think I'm right that just today or yesterday, the courts called that the poll tax, it was. But there are going to be skirmishes like that all over the country. And then if you add to that COVID-19 and the social distancing that we are supposed to observe, and what some of the models say about a potential resurgence of virus later in the year, I'm deeply worried about participation, which has always been relatively low in America relative to other industrialized democracies. So I hope people will use absentee ballots, that we will expand mail-in or computer-based voting with all the necessary precautions, because I think this is an election that is about more than the character of the candidates. This one's about the character of the country.
So throughout your career, you've tried to be bipartisan, and you just talked about how you don't have to hate Republicans. How can we see more bipartisanship, and is that even possible with the Republican Party under Donald Trump?
Well, I think the answer to that question probably ought better to come from a Republican, because it's going to be. I mean, somebody was just making this point the other day that whatever you think of impeachment, there were impeachable offenses demonstrated, and that only one member of the Republican Senate would vote to acknowledge those breaches of duty is worrisome. And the number of times I read or hear Republicans on the on television or on the radio say that their friends, they hear upset about a comment that the president made about his support of the Uber right and so forth, but then they won't break with him on policy. It's worrisome. You know, because leadership isn't all legislation. It's also about the tone you set. It's about the generosity of spirit that you show. It's about grace, as I was saying earlier. It's about how to comfort and pull people together in a crisis. Never in my wildest dreams would I have imagined that a health crisis like this pandemic could be politicized, could be turned into a contest between Republicans and Democrats, but it feels like it's become that. And I think if you get below the federal level, you see more bipartisan actions and activities, and that's a good thing. And I think what we have to do is elevate those and show those to people as examples of what's still possible.
So kind of building off of that, you worked in a variety of different leadership positions. So what have you learned about how to be a strong, effective leader who leads with compassion and grace rather than with fear?
Well, I'm still learning. But I would say there are a handful of sort of lessons I take away. One is, leadership is, it's... entrusted. It's, you're not entitled to it, it's entrusted. So there's a humility, I think, that's important for successful leadership. I think it's important also to want to do something with your leadership opportunity, not just have it, but to do it. And I think that requires you to be visionary. You try to lean forward. You try to leave things better for those who come behind you. I think it's important to listen. No person, no candidate, no party has a corner on all the best ideas. And so it is, I think, a sign of confidence to have a vision about where you want to go, but to be open to contributions, competing ideas, or just better ideas about how to accomplish your vision than your own ideas. And I think to a point I was making earlier, it's important to be optimistic because, you know, leadership, I think, you know, it's not just a role. It's an opportunity. And to this notion of generational responsibility, we should be trying to get to something better that we then hand to those who come behind us. And I think optimism, because there will always be setbacks, optimism is a fuel. And I think that's important to bring to bear as well.
So lastly, as governor, you worked with constituents and organizations from all across the state on a daily basis. From your experience, what do you think is the best way for people, especially young people, to be involved in their communities and help on a grassroots level?
You know, when I was first running, remember, I hadn't run for anything before. And I remember we were working at the grassroots really for two reasons, one philosophical and one practical. The practical reason was, as I said earlier, we wanted to... this is a hard political establishment to break into in Massachusetts. And so the only way it was going to happen is if we inserted ourselves through a grassroots movement that just overwhelmed the political establishment. But the philosophical reason was that I wanted to invite people to check in who had checked out or who had never checked in before. I wanted them to see their own stake in our political and civic future and to make the campaign theirs and to make the administration theirs. And so we talked to everybody all over the place, in the places where all the wise guys and gals said were where the vote was concentrated and in the places that had been consistently overlooked. And there was a remarkable consistency in what people were feeling, that all over the Commonwealth, they were feeling unseen and unheard, as if Beacon Hill was just about the neighborhood right around Beacon Hill. And I think that, you know, in those early days, when you couldn't get anybody to, you know, even get my name in the right order, let alone take me seriously as a candidate, there were a number of teachers who would let me come to their classes and talk about the process of civic engagement and of politics. And a lot of these classes were, you know, kids who weren't voting age. But you got a chance to come in and say hello and talk about what we were doing and you know, talk about what citizenship meant. And what I found to my, you know, absolute delight, Bridget, is that over time, a number of parents came to the campaign through their kids. It wasn't what we set out to do. It was just, you know, those were the venues we could get. But the kids got excited about the campaign and started to volunteer and be helpful. And eventually, and I remember a number of conversations. One sticks out where on a Saturday, there was a mom doing a phone bank at one of our campaign offices next to her daughter. And when the mom introduced herself, she said, "I just needed to come down here and see what it is my 15-year-old was so excited about, because I haven't seen her this focused and engaged in anything before." So I think there are ways in which paying attention to this notion, again, of generational responsibility, that we are not about or ought not be about just the people who voted for us or the people who can vote, but about what it is we leave for a generation that comes behind. If you are mindful about that, I think it in our campaigns, and I hope in our administration, it came through, and there are an awful lot of people who came to the cause for that reason. And I'm really, really proud of that.
So that is all the time we have for today. So we just want to thank our partners, America's Promise Alliance, Nancy Donahue and the Greater Lowell Community Foundation, all our listeners and viewers, and thank you so much to Governor Patrick for being with us today and sharing all your time and knowledge.
My pleasure. It's my pleasure. Thank you so very much for having me. All the best. Stay safe.
We hope you enjoyed our discussion with Governor Patrick.
To learn more about Leaders in Lowell, please check out our website at leadersinlowell.org and our Instagram at leadersinlowellofficial. Our next talk will be held and released on May 28th, and it will feature a discussion with Corey Lewandowski, a political operative and the former campaign manager for the Trump campaign. We hope to bring you many more discussions with leaders in the coming weeks, so check our website and social media accounts for all the info.
Again, thank you to Governor Patrick, and thank you all for tuning in. We hope to see you again soon.